Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I want you to know that the mothership has landed.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
What's up, my brother? I want permission to come aboard the mothership.
Asking permission to join a sports talk spaceship? Well, we're all a little crazy. The mothership has connected.
The mothership. Let's come aboard.
And a happy Thursday. We come to you live from the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loan Studios. Home is more than a house. It's a personal paradise. Get yours. Rocket Mortgage. Push button. Get mortgage. Thanks so much for being with us, everybody. DA with you here on CBS Sports Radio. And we know there's a void in your life. We know that without the NCAA tournament, no brackets being busted, no buzzer beaters, no Cinderellas, there has been a natural void, and we've tried to fill that for you here on the DA Show every single day this month. We've gone down memory lane and walked the road of some of the greatest moments and games and performances and Cinderella runs in NCAA tournament history. If you were watching CBS this past weekend, you saw some classic games that included the 1982 National Championship game. North Carolina, Georgetown. The only National Championship game ever which would feature three different all-time basketball players in NBA history, three of the top 50 players ever on that list. That was Michael Jordan hitting an impeccable shot late. You had Patrick Ewing manning the center for Georgetown and James Worthy with a standout performance for the Heels. Let's go back in time. It's time for the madness of March.
It's to Jenkins, to Drew for the win! Go!
They can get in better shooting range.
There's the pass to Leitner. Puts it up.
Yes! Shot clock turned off. Calgary. Hall. Eight to shoot. Hall. The runner. Loose ball. It's good. With 4.4 to go. Shannon. Don't want to foul. Shannon from the corner. And it's over. Gonzaga. The slipper still fits. They win.
Buzzer beaters, bracket busters, iconic moments, the greatest stories of the NCAA tournament. It's the madness of March.
Jordy to Black. The time, 18. Shot, Jordan, Michael Jordan. And Georgetown loses it. North Carolina has won the 1982 NCAA championship.
Our next guest was a starter on that 82 UNC squad, would end up becoming the head coach at Notre Dame, North Carolina, FAU, and SMU. Joining us here on the show this morning for the Madness of March is Matt Doherty. Matt, good morning. How you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me on the show. It was wonderful hearing those highlights and those voices and Gus Johnson, Gary Bender. I mean, those were exciting times.
No doubt about it. And now without the NCAA tournament, it means a little bit more. And you were part of one of the great games in college basketball history. Let's go back to the beginning for you at North Carolina. You were a McDonald's All-American. You had many schools that were interested in you. Dean Smith, though, came calling. What was it about North Carolina and Dean Smith that sold you on the Tar Heels?
Well, I think the first thing, I'm from Long Island, New York, and the Big East was just forming in 1979. I wanted to play in the league. I was really interested at Virginia, Duke, North Carolina, and Notre Dame. Notre Dame was an independent at the time. So I really wanted to play in the league, the excitement of a league. I was wired that way growing up. I played for Bob McKillop in high school, who's now the head coach at Davidson. Played at Holy Trinity High School, and we had a great Catholic league back then. And then Dick Zeitler, with Dick Zeitler, we won the state championship and ironically played against Freddie Brown of Georgetown and Ed Pickney of Villanova in the semifinals. They were at Adelaide Stevenson. So I enjoyed the excitement, the energy of conference play, and there was no better league than the ACC. So then you look at the ACC and you say, who has the best chance of winning a national championship each year? And that was North Carolina. And then on top of that, you know, the way Coach Smith played, I knew he'd appreciate what I could do as opposed to what I couldn't. I knew at that early age what I couldn't do. I wasn't a great athlete, but I could pass, handle, and shoot the ball and play with savvy. And those are things that he really valued.
Certainly, Dean Smith was a legend by the time you got to campus in Chapel Hill, but he had not won a national championship yet. That was the one hole on his resume. When you guys enter the 1982 season, and you guys are pretty loaded, obviously, Sam Perkins, James Worthy, yourself, Michael Jordan, was there ever a sense, hey, we got to get one for Dean, or is that just a narrative that the national media would talk about?
No, we did. I mean, we did internally. We certainly, I mean, a couple things. One, it sounds very unselfish, right? You want to serve, but it's also selfish because the Carolina basketball family is real. I mean, you've got about 200 players, and there's nothing like going to a reunion and going over to Mitch Kupchak or Tyler Hansborough or Ty Lawson, guys that I don't really know, but you know because of the thread of Carolina basketball, and saying, yeah, you guys are pretty good, but we got to miss first. So, you know, that's a pretty cool feeling to have a little bit of bragging rights within the Carolina family.
You guys were a very good team that year. You were one of the best teams preseason-wise in the nation. But when you got onto the floor, what did you sense about the team and about the talent? Were you guys better than you would have thought, as good? Did you think there was more work to be done when you guys first started playing together that season?
Well, the thing was, we went to the championship game the year before, and the only player we lost we lost two starters, Mike Pepper and Al Wood. I was the sixth man the year before, so I stepped into the starting role for basically Michael Pepper, and, you know, this guy named Michael Jordan came in and stepped in for Al Wood. So it was basically the same team. And we knew we were good. We knew what we were capable of. We had really good guys. I think that's such an important thing to recognize, the high character of the guys, the unselfishness. James Worthy was the first player picked in the draft that year, and he was an All-American, the player of the, you know, MVP of the Final Four. He only averaged 15 points a game. Everyone jokes about Dean Smith was the only one that could keep Michael under 20 points a game. We had really good players. You know, even after that, we had Kenny Smith and Brad Daugherty. And the rules were such that you didn't have a shot clock, you didn't have a three-point line, and we were very patient. We were going to get good shots and hit the open man. And so, you know, there's certain memories through that season where the leadership of a Jimmy Black and a James Worthy carried us through some challenging games. Our biggest concern was our depth. We didn't have great depth. You know, we had, you know, Jimmy Braddock came in at the point for Jimmy Black. We had Buzz Peterson. We had Chris Brust. But we were a little bit thin. So injury was a concern. Sam Perkins got sick and missed a couple of games. And I think we lost one of those at home. We lost to Wake Forest. So we had to stay healthy, and that's where luck comes into play.
Matt Doherty joins us this morning on the show. The Madness of March, reliving some of the great moments in NCAA tournament history, the 82 National Championship game. You enter the NCAA tournament as a one seed. Georgetown is as well. But you guys get a bit of a scare in the first game that you play against number 9 seed James Madison. You survive at 52-50. Would it be a sign of things to come? You guys played a lot of tight games in that tournament. What do you remember from a tough game against the 9 seed in your first matchup?
Yeah, that was in Charlotte. Lou Campanelli was the coach who ended up coaching at Cal, where he coached Jason Kidd. They played a flex offense. They were kind of a grinded out team. A lot of teams that go on to win the championship win those close games early. And, you know, is it overconfidence? Is it expectations? Is it the human nature comes into play? You know, kids, human beings, we're not robots. So you can say, oh, you plug it in. Yeah, the spread says they should win by 22 points and you blow them out by two. So it was certainly a scare. But when you're in the moment, when you're in the game, you're playing. You're just playing one possession at a time and trying to figure it out. And then you deal with the repercussions afterwards, whether it's victory or defeat.
You could make the argument the 1982 Final Four is the most talented Final Four ever assembled, because not only did you guys have future NBA all-stars and all-timers in Worthy and Michael Jordan. You face off against a Georgetown team led by Patrick Ewing. There was also Phi Slamajama in that Final Four that you guys had to play in the Final Four. And so you guys take on Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler in the Final Four, and you end up winning that game. What was that matchup like just to get to a national championship game?
Well, back then, the AAU circuit wasn't as big in high school basketball. And then Texas had some unique restrictions because it was such a football state at the time, and it still is to a certain extent. But the high school basketball players weren't really well known outside of Texas. And then all of a sudden, and Olajuwon, I don't know if Olajuwon started that year. He might have come off the bench. Maybe he did, but he wasn't, you know, a polished player like he became in the NBA. But I remember, you know, introductions, and they went by position, and you go out to half court and shake hands, and I'm shaking hands with Clyde Drexler, you know, and that's my man. That's who I'm going to try to guard. Now, fortunately, I had some experience in practice and in pickup games trying to guard Michael Jordan. So I tried not to embarrass myself. That was my defensive mode, admitting that publicly on the air. Like, don't get embarrassed. So it really is fascinating. Louisville was in the Final Four, and they had Rodney McRae, who ended up having a great career, mainly with the Houston Rockets. So, yes, it was an extremely talented Final Four. And that's why I get a little fired up when some of these pundits now say, oh, that's a great team, that's a great team, or he's a great player, you know, and I'm like, dude, whoa, pump the brakes. That guy wouldn't have started on our 1982 national championship team. He wouldn't have gotten time in that Final Four, because that's how good those guys were. I mean, Sam Perkins played 4 years. James Worthy played three. Michael Jordan played three. Nowadays, those guys are one and done.
No doubt. And it's a time when the real true giants of college basketball ruled the earth, where Georgetown is in the Final Four almost every year. You had Phi Slamajama, yourselves. They were really the titans of the sport, where we don't really have that anymore because, as you mentioned, guys don't stick around long enough. So you guys end up beating Houston 68-63, and now the matchup against Georgetown. At this point in time, John Thompson has Hoya paranoia. He's got the Georgetown program humming. They are great villains for the sport of basketball, and Patrick Ewing is one of these guys that you wonder, how can you possibly stop this guy? Entering this national championship game, 2-1 seeds, 2 behemoths, you and Georgetown, what's your feeling going up against a guy like Ewing that kind of cast a shadow over everything in college hoops?
Well, he came out and goaltended, I think, the first 5 shots of the game. Ironically, I didn't realize it till watching the re-air on Saturday that I scored the first actual basket of that game for Carolina, the ball that actually went through the hoop. And but we were not fazed. See, we played against Ralph Sampson. People don't know Ralph Sampson was 7'4". He was like a 7'4" Kevin Garnett. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so we had to go against Sampson, you know, 2-3 times a year. We played him 3 times that year. So in terms of defending the goal and blocking shots around the rim, we faced that. So this was not something that scared us. As a matter of fact, I remember after about the 3rd, 4th goaltend huddling up the team saying, hey, you know, they're trying to intimidate us. Screw that. Just keep throwing it inside, James, and turn around and shoot it. Let them goaltend. And so we were not, you know, intimidated at all. The thing that impressed me about Patrick at that point, I don't think he was really known as a scorer, more as a defensive shot blocker. And he came out and was hitting turnaround jumpers and really some nice moves around the basket. As I look back, his first shot was a turnaround on the baseline, on the left baseline, where he was behind the backboard a little bit. And that high arcing turnaround jumper was really tough to stop.
Matt Doherty joins us for the 1982 National Championship game from the UNC Tar Heels, having the banner, hanging the banner, and that crazy shot by, well, the crazy ending, rather, and the great shot by Michael Jordan as we relive that night here on the on CBS Sports Radio. You know, as that game goes on, it ends up becoming an instant classic. Back and forth you guys go. When you're watching it on TV last weekend, does a lot of the memories of being in the moment come back to you, or do you notice a lot of things that maybe you didn't realize as you were playing the game?
I think both. This was the first time since probably like May of 1982 where I watched it in full.
Really?
Even though President Trump, you know, had the press conference, my family watched it on YouTube and the second half. And it was really cool to watch it with my wife and 2 kids. I have a 22-year-old and a 20-year-old. My daughter attends the University of North Carolina. And so to see their reactions, and a lot of times the reaction was more towards the shorts and how dark my hair was. And, you know, like, you know, Michael Jordan really struggled at times in that game. I mean, he finished with, I think, 19 and had a great layup over Ewing and obviously hit the game winner. But he turned the ball over a couple times, had his shot blocked. And to see, you know, hear Billy Packer say, oh, this freshman's, you know, nervous. And, you know, you're like, wow, if he only knew, like how, you know, this guy would maybe be the best player of all time. So you go back and you see some moments, and I always think back to the mistakes. I think, I don't know if I'm wired maybe a little different, but, you know, I always cringe. You know, I missed a big foul shot at the front end of a 1-on-1 with a minute and 30 to go. You know, some other turnovers, they stick with me. And as I watch the game, it's like, you know what, I was okay. Yeah, I made some mistakes, but, you know, I didn't embarrass myself. That I look like I played with confidence, even though there were a lot of butterflies at times.
So take us inside a young Michael Jordan. What was he like at that point in time? How did he adapt to the team? How did you guys look at him?
Well, Michael came in and was you know, somewhat cocky. And Coach Smith always made sure the star freshman was kind of, you know, squashed a little bit. But he had a gift of trying to control the temperament a little bit, but also allowing him to flourish. And he started him. I think Michael was like the first starter as a freshman. I think James Worthy started as a freshman. Sam did, but the first freshman to start his first game might have been Phil Ford. And so that was unique. But Michael, we all respected him because, one, he was talented as all get out. And two, he was a sponge. He listened, he learned, and he competed. And to see him early in practice, his ability to go into the lane and hang and be able to find the basket and lay it up with spin and touch was really remarkable. And then, obviously, his defensive abilities. The thing that really jumps out when you watch those games, to me, one of the first things, is with the short shorts, you can really see how long the arms are on some of these players and how big their hands are. I mean, Sam Perkins' arms literally almost touch his knees. Patrick Ewing, Michael Jordan, the length on those players was remarkable.
Matt Doherty joins us to relive the 1982 National Championship game. It's back and forth all day long, all night long. Late, Georgetown leads the game, and then Michael hits the go-ahead jumper. And then there's a mad scramble at the end. Georgetown brings back the ball, trailing by one. They're trying to set up a play. They can't do so. And then the errant pass right to James Worthy, which ends up going down as a blunder in the NCAA tournament's history. They come back down the floor. There's a couple of free throws. There's no timeout taken by John Thompson, or none, rather, left for Thompson right to take. And so they've got to heave one up. What do you remember about that crazy, mad scramble final couple of seconds that you're on the floor for?
Well, I had missed a foul shot earlier, and so, but I was just looking for my man. You know, I was guarding, I think, Eric Smith. So I was just, you know, trying to be in good defensive position. So I just, at the last minute, saw Freddie throw the ball to James, and James dribbling down the court. And then I was just hoping he'd make the foul shots. You know, there's no three-point line. And then looking at the game again the other day, realizing that, you know, maybe John Thompson wished he didn't call a timeout. I think he probably was trying to ice James, but he really could have used it to call timeout on the rebound and then at least have a chance to throw it to Ewing in the lane and maybe tip it in for the victory. But you feel for Freddie. I played against Freddie in high school. It could have been any one of us. I mean, I missed a foul shot. I could have been the GOAT. Not the greatest of all time, but the GOAT in that game. And you think of Bill Buckner when the ball, Mookie Wilson's grounder went through his, or Bill,
Bill Buckner.
Who, Bill Buckner, but I forget who hit the ball through his legs, and I think Mookie Wilson scored or Ray Knight scored. And, you know, that's the risk. And that's the old adage, thrill of victory, the agony of defeat, not to quote another station, but you know, that's sports, and that's why it's the best reality TV in the world. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. It's not scripted. And so for that to happen is agonizing. It happened, ironically, 11 years later when Chris Webber called a timeout, Michigan playing North Carolina again in the Superdome.
Yep, exactly right. And so I just wanted to know from an inside the huddle standpoint, you know, Worthy had the game of the day, the game of the night for any of the players that were on the floor. He was fantastic. But did Dean Smith want to shift the ball to Michael for that final shot?
You know, I don't recall that. This is what I do recall. 32 seconds to go, calls timeout. And he was the master, and I run a leadership practice now, and I talk a lot about communication and obviously leadership, and his leadership in that moment was spectacular because he always would smile in times of duress and give us the needed confidence because everyone's going to defer to the leader, and 50% of communication is body language. So Coach Smith was very relaxed, and he would smile. And there'd be a twinkle in his eye. And in other games, he would say, wouldn't it be fun to win this game? Well, in that game, he said, we're right where we want to be. This is what we're going to do. Now, he knew, he felt they were going to come out in a zone because he said that John Thompson really, really loved James Worthy and wanted to make sure that Worthy wasn't getting the ball inside. So they went into a zone. And we went into what we call our T game, which is just an offense against the zone. And I do believe this. When we broke the huddle, I think Coach Smith went up to every player because I know he went up to me and he said, if you're open, knock it down. Okay, now he may have whispered it to me and yelled it at Michael Jordan, but he did say it. And so that's the confidence of a leader, and especially against the zone. You can really only put your players in position and trust that they'll make the right play. And to this day, D.A., it blows me away to see Michael Jordan catch that ball with 17 seconds to go and fire it in because he didn't have a great game up to that point. He had a good game, but, and he's a freshman. He's a freshman with James Worthy and Sam Perkins on the court. There's 63,000 people at the game. It's the first time they played in the domed arena. And he could have easily shot faked the ball and moved it, but he took it. I mean, Ed Spriggs and Eric Smith were within range where, you know, it wasn't like it was a wide open shot. I mean, it was an open shot, but he could have easily pump faked it and kicked it. But that's Michael Jordan that we have grown to know and love, that he has it. He has whatever you want to call it. He has it. And that came through on that final shot in 1982.
It's one of the great games in NCAA tournament history. It was replayed last weekend by CBS. UNC wins the first title for Dean Smith, 63-62 in the 1982 Final Four. Matt Doherty joining us, a starter on that Tar Heels team this morning on the show. Well, Coach, this was so much fun to do. Thanks for being so generous with your time. I know this was a big block of time we asked you to do, but this was so much fun. We really appreciate it around here. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and it was a real honor to be a part of that CBS broadcast, and thank you, DA, for having me on this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Coach. Hopefully we can catch up again.
Sure thing.
Matt Doherty joining us this morning on the show, The Madness of March, here on the DA Show. That was so much fun going back into the archives. 1982 National Championship game. How about that Final Four? When you have North Carolina that has James Worthy and Michael Jordan playing Houston, Phi Slamma Jamma, that has Clyde Drexler and Hakeem Olajuwon, ending up playing Patrick Ewing in Georgetown in the national championship game. Those three teams combined for how many NBA Hall of Famers? Five NBA Hall of Famers played in the 1982 Final Four. Five NBA Hall of Famers. When we come back here on the show, the NFL draft for 7 days? DA, CBS Sports Radio.
It's the show about the show. Here's the best of this week's Permission Granted podcast.
I actually am doing things around my house that I otherwise would have put off. I did things like I fertilized my lawn.
Nice.
I also am in the process, and I spoiler alert on this, I'm in the process of building a Bob's Bar second location of my house.
Oh, is that right?
The goal is by the end of April to have a second Bob's Bar location built in my backyard, and I would not otherwise be doing that if not for the quarantine.
I love that.
Find the PGP every week on radio.com, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else podcasts are downloaded.
Yes, get inside the PGP. Get inside the DA Show this week with the Permission Granted podcast, the show about the show. We discuss what's going on under house arrest, home quarantine, isolation. We discuss in depth on this week's PGP, available all places podcasts are downloaded, and tell your smart speaker, play the Permission Granted podcast. Believe me, it'll do it for you. Now, we're toll-free line sponsored by Geico this morning. Whether you own or rent, Geico makes it easy to bundle home and auto insurance. Having a home, hard work. Get a quote, geico.com. Easy. So Adam Schefter floated this proposal that this year's NFL draft should be 7 days long, a full week. Usually, it's just 3 days. He's saying it should be 7 days, 1 day for each round. Now, once upon a time, the draft was just 2 days. Now it's 3 days. He's suggesting 7 days. In the wake of coronavirus lockdown, in the wake of no sports anywhere, I have to say, I fully support this proposal. If you give us a full week next month of NFL draft, round one on a Monday or a Sunday, round two the next day, right through 7 full days, I'm into it. I'm watching more draft than I've ever watched if that's the case. If I can take a breather each day and know it's only one round each day, it also puts so much significance on every pick for your team because you know every day there's a buildup to that pick. I don't think you could normally do this if there were no sports, if there were sports going on. I don't think under normal circumstances it makes sense to have your league come together 7 freaking days to pick players off of a board. But in this case, I got to say, I like it. I'm into it. It would give us a full week of sports, and we need that right now. So I'm in support of it. Would it be at times deathly boring? Perhaps. knowing that a full day is dedicated to the sixth round? Yeah, maybe. If we dedicated a full day to guy that will never make the roster, yeah, maybe. Overkill. But I'm all for this. Number two, I got to think this is a test balloon by the NFL. If Schefter is throwing this out there, I got to think he has run this by NFL officials, or NFL officials have said, throw this out there. Let's see what the public reaction would be. Because, Mraz, we know Adam Schefter is as connected as anybody. And when Schefter reported on Monday Night Football midway through the season, Tom Brady is preparing not to be a Patriot next year, people acted as though he had lost his mind. What are you talking about? And we said on the air the next day, Schefter doesn't just say things. He does not just spitball. He doesn't throw things against the wall like other commentators. This is a guy connected, and look what happened. Mraz, I got to think that he's got it on good source that the NFL is kicking around this idea.
I hope you're right, because if we get, as Adam Schefter called it, the Hanukkah of NFL draft, to me, that is what the sports world needs and is waiting for. Could you imagine on FaceTime or group chats with your buddies as we go into night five, breaking down what inside linebacker your team's going to take out of BYU in the fifth round? We need this. 7 nights of a sporting event? The chance for Mr. Irrelevant come that last night, knowing that could be the last time we see sports for a couple more weeks. I haven't seen an idea like this in quite a long time. Forget sports. Forget life. 7 nights of the NFL draft while we have no sports? This shouldn't even be a discussion or a test balloon. It should just be the case already. Make it happen.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want this if there were regular sports
going on. No. But that's beside the point. We don't have regular sports going on. What have we heard? Scouts and GMs have now also complained that they can't get in and can't get a chance to do their final research, medical records, pro days have been canceled, all of that, right? So what is a good offset to these GMs and coaches? Giving them a chance to breathe after every round, a full day, go back, go through the notes we do have, let's see what we want, and giving everybody the same clock that we have in the first round, 10 minutes in between each pick. Because by the time you usually get to rounds 4, 5, 6, 7, you have about a minute and a half between each pick. It's flying. Kiper and McShay can't even keep up with who's being picked. Sometimes your team makes a pick you don't even realize until an hour later, and you got to see it scroll across. Now if you're giving GMs and scouts and a television audience watching 10 minutes each night between each pick, it gives them, it's a win for the league, it's a win for the viewer, it's a win for sports fans. To me, there's too much positive for this not to happen, and it's not as if you need to figure out a venue. You throw this in Secaucus or whatever venue you're having your NFL coverage come from. That's it. You don't have to rent out Vegas or the Bellagio now because of what's going on. This has to happen.
Well, you don't have to rent out anywhere because this is all going to be remote
right. Broadcast.
All these guys are going to be in their own war rooms and just send in their picks. Then you're just going to have some commentators analyzing it. I tend to believe that the NFL is really into this, and it's because look at some of the breadcrumbs. There were people that said, oh, push back the NFL league year. You don't want to do this in the middle of coronavirus. We can't have free agency start and free agents can't visit. The NFL steamrolled ahead. Nope, we're keeping it on track. They, at this point, have had, you know, concerns about even doing the draft. They're like, nope, we're doing the draft. It won't be in Vegas, but we're doing the draft the same day. I think the NFL looks at this as a chance to capitalize on a dead sports zone, and they've already done it by saying the draft is staying the same date, the league year starts the same date, we're going to have free agency start the same date. They're plowing through the yield signs. I think they're going to do this. I think they're going to give us a week of the NFL draft, and like I said, I support it. I think it's a good idea. If you can tell us we've got a full week of at least something is happening in sports to get our minds off of things happening, I think it's a good idea. But could you imagine the overthinking when you have these front offices have a full day to think about their sixth round and seventh round picks? Oh, the overthinking that will happen, the overanalysis is going to be glorious.
Oh, I can't wait. I hope that we are in a position where our cold open is examining what the Texans did and Bill O'Brien did in the seventh round. That is a world right now I am dying to live in.
So that is floated out there by Adam Schefter suggesting a Hanukkah of the NFL draft. I guess that would be 8 crazy nights. This might be 7 crazy nights. Standing by is our good friend and a kind Sir Andrew Bogish here with his voice to lend us some thoughts on the headlines of the day. Good morning, Andrew.
DA, good morning. So sadly, baseball fields will be quiet on opening day, but MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred, speaking last night on ESPN, says his sport will be there when the nation needs it.
It's an honor for our sport to be regarded in a way that we have been part of our country coming back from some horrific events, and we hope that we can play a similar role with respect to
Manfred
this
acknowledged that playing a full 162-game schedule is likely impossible. They'll be as creative as possible to get in as many games when they do start. Manfred hopes they can begin making actual plans for that in May. One other thing he mentioned last night, the investigation into Red Sox cheating in 2018 is complete, but has not yet been put into writing. That'll happen, and we'll get the announcement before the season starts. The latest effects of the sports shutdown include the NHL postponing its draft scheduled for late June in Montreal, and StubHub putting employees on furlough. The ticket company says this was a difficult but responsible decision. These furloughs reportedly involved 2/3 of the staff. Dak Prescott and the Cowboys said to be back at the bargaining table. These are their first talks since Dallas gave its QB the exclusive franchise tag. Contract length has apparently the last hurdle. The Cowboys want to do a 5-year deal. Dak wants 4, which gets him another payday sooner. Saints head coach Sean Payton says he is healthy after fighting the coronavirus last week. As for football, Payton declaring Taysom Hill the backup QB for next season. He was technically number 3 last year. Hill has only thrown 13 passes in his NFL career. A backup role might be the only thing Cam Newton can find eventually. It's a pretty startling fall for the 2015 MVP. His former head coach, Ron Rivera, told WFNZ Radio in Charlotte 2016 was the beginning of the end.
That season really, to me, was really the kind of the crux of it all in terms of, you know, the slowdown and then kind of the spiral. I mean, if you go back and look at what happened in 2016, I think that's the season I point to as, I wish we could have had things differently.
The
there.
Panthers went from the Super Bowl to 6-10 and no playoffs in 2016. Woo. Bounced back with a wild card in 17, but then 12-21 over the last two seasons, which is why both Rivera and Cam are now out in Carolina.
I mean, basically, Ron Rivera just said it was the beginning of the end for Cam Newton. That talk about not sugarcoating it, saying that this is the moment it started spiraling downward for Cam, that's a pretty damning quote to say about a former NFL MVP that's only 30 years old.
Yeah, and it does include all of them, but Cam's in the middle of all of that. And, you know, I still think Cam's got some football inside of him, but between the injuries and all the other things working against him and him messing things up as well in Carolina, he's been a bottom third quarterback for the last 2+ seasons. The numbers don't necessarily lie. He just hasn't been good enough. He hasn't been healthy enough. And whether or not he's healthy moving forward remains the big question, obviously.
Also shows how ridiculous some of those rumors were last week that Washington would be in on Cam Newton, if you're hearing Ron Rivera speak that way now.
True. That's absolutely true. But saying that it was the beginning of the end suggests that it's the end, suggests that this was a finality. And maybe Ron Rivera is talking about the end of his Carolina tenure, but it kind of sounded like he was talking about the end of Cam Newton being Cam Newton, which would suggest that if you do sign Cam Newton, you're not getting anything close to what he once upon a time was.
Staying under center real quick, NFL Network says the Bengals are open to keeping Andy Dalton after they draft Joe Burrow. And we finish with some good news. LeBron James donating 1,300 meals to families from his I Promise school in Akron. Mets first baseman Pete Alonso taping personalized messages to doctors and nurses. And Conor McGregor buying over $100,000 worth of protective gear for hospitals in Ireland. DA?
Thank you, Bogues. You know, a lot of players have stepped up and done good things. We talked about and highlighted some of them yesterday, but it is worth noting that the sports world has done a pretty cool job of supporting those that need to be supported through this time. Nice job, LeBron, like a nice job by a lot of players that have stepped up in this time of need. Very cool. When we come back here on the show, it is baseball opening day, as Bogues just alluded to in that update, which means that a lot of people like to wear their jerseys today. I cannot do so because I don't have any jerseys anymore. Mraz is irate. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
This is CBS.
It's the DA Show on CBS Sports Radio.
Every single day you can listen to us across the great CBS Sports Radio network. Hundreds of affiliates nationwide and north of the border. Also on Sirius XM Channel 206. And watch us, won't you? You can watch us at watchda.com or inside the radio.com app. You can stream us as well. Use the radio.com app, Apple Music, the CBS Sports app, or other streaming outlets to listen to the DA Show. And you can also listen to us in podcast form as well. Today should have been Major League Baseball's opening day, and one tradition amongst people, certainly around our workplace, is to wear a jersey of the team of your choice, of your favorite team. So Bogues asked yesterday on the G-Chat that we have going on with the show, will you be wearing a jersey tomorrow? And I said, I can't because I don't have any jerseys anymore. Oh. I either sold the ones worth some money on eBay or I donated them to Goodwill. But I don't have jerseys anymore. And this did not lead to much of a response from Bogish, but Mraz was beside himself, angry that I had done such a thing. What are you so angry about? I'm 40 years old now.
So you're 40? That's just some arbitrary age where you could throw out being a kiddie kind of fan? I hate these rules that people make up when they get to a certain age.
You make up rules all the time.
Real rules, DA. Real rules. Not I turned 40, suddenly I'm too good to wear my Daryl Strawberry throwback I only ordered 4 years ago, and now I got to take to eBay to sell it. You now have entered the category of being a fraud fan. I don't care how much money you spend on tickets at Citi Field. This is ridiculous. You're a sports fan. You've bought jerseys. You've owned jerseys. They're cool to have. What says because you turn 40 now you got to show up to games wearing Argyle freaking sweaters? Get the Daryl Strawberry jersey on your back. Get ready for opening day and stop the arbitrary rules.
Here's what you don't understand, is that not everybody has to live by your rules. I'm not judging other people that do it. You want to wear jerseys all day long, every day of your life, fine.
Stop.
I hit a certain age where I'm an adult, and I can't be rocking jerseys and not feel like a chump.
Adults at games every week wearing jerseys.
Yeah, and they all look like chumps to me.
Oh, stop it. Stop it. Bob the Deli Man sitting at home probably in his wrinkled Victor Cruz jersey right now. He'll wear it to the day he dies. We might bury him in it. And suddenly you're too good as a 40-year-old man suddenly. Ridiculous. Stop it. Sports fan. You got into sports radio. Wear your jerseys proudly.
I'm still a huge sports fan, but there's other ways to support your team than wearing a jersey. I can wear a T-shirt. I can wear a hoodie. I can wear a hat. I can wear plenty of things to support my team. Don't you ever remember a time before people wore jerseys to games? Just look at television. If you looked at any game prior to like the 1990s, few people are in jerseys. And if you go back to like the 50s, everybody's in hats and suits.
So let's go back to the 50s then, and we'll literally only have boiled hot dogs at every game. And sit there and keep score the whole time. Times have changed. Be hip. Wear your jersey. That's part of being a fan. You don't want to paint your face. That's fine. I'm sitting here right now. Look at this. I got a freaking closet back here banging around. I see 43 jerseys. Well, I'm counting right there.
Here's your problem, okay? And it's not mine. I'm not judging. You can wear as many jerseys as you want. But here's the thing. Your wardrobe doesn't evolve. The way that you were at 18 years old is the way that you are now.
I just got a Garrett Cole jersey. How has it not evolved?
There's things that I don't wear that I used to wear in high school. You just grow up and you get into other things. Didn't you ever hear the Jay-Z lyric, I don't wear jerseys, I'm 30 plus, give me a crisp pair of jeans and button-ups. That's Jay-Z.
First of all, let Pete rap that.
That's Jay-Z. You never heard this line? He said it. You don't wear jerseys after the age of 30.
Okay, so let's just lean on Jay-Z, who's now written the rules of adulthood. You're speaking to an audience of people that wear jerseys. Because I know I can connect with the fan. There are so many fans listening right now that are 40 years old or over, and they can't wait to wear their NFL jerseys on Sunday and get
to
the
game. Go ahead and do it.
And you're too good for it because you got to wear a hoodie and some kind of knit cap to a game. I mean,
As though that makes me better than anybody. It's just a fashion choice.
Oh, your fashion sucks.
Nice. Really good take. Really. This is coming from a guy that wears undersized, old, tattered jerseys with stains on them to work.
This is a guy.
And you can count on one hand the times he has ironed a shirt.
When was the last time I did that?
This is a guy that would prefer wearing sweatpants to work. I mean, why would I take my wardrobe tips from you?
Because I know what's right and what's wrong when it comes to sports fandom. Uh-huh. You're a fraud now. Fraud.
I'm a fraud because I don't have jerseys anymore.
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense. None. When we come back, Major League Fishing, Ott Defoe is going to join us. Plus, you can weigh in on our jersey debate at DA on CBS.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.